Hello and welcome to this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast in the Inner Sanctum. I thought that this week I might talk, hopefully wax eloquent, certainly talk anyway, about William Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar. This is in my mind at the moment for two reasons. Last week I was visiting convent, a community of Dominican sisters, the Dominican Sisters of Fonjeau in Messina, New York, and they also run a girls' school. So I gave six talks, three just to the sisters in private, and two to the public, and a third was the graduation address for the senior class at Holy Name of Jesus Academy, which is the school that the sisters run. But the focus of two of my private sessions with the sisters themselves was Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. So that's the first reason why it's in my mind. And secondly, tomorrow, I am recording this on Thursday, tomorrow morning with my regular courses that I'm teaching to my friends in Chile, Santiago, Chile, an organization called Red Cultural, CultureNet. I will also be talking about Julius Caesar tomorrow to them. So this is in my mind. So I thought, well, why don't I share my thoughts on the play with my friends in the Inner Sanctum, which is what I'm now doing. So Julius Caesar, it might be the most popular of Shakespeare's plays in terms of its being a set text at high school level. I think the only other play perhaps which rivals it in terms of it, how often it's on the curriculum at schools is probably Romeo and Juliet, both of which I can see why they're fairly accessible. And Romeo and Juliet is hideously abused by the way it's taught. And in my book, Shakespeare on Love, exposes the misreading of that play. But that's another discussion. Maybe we will do that some other time. But Julius Caesar, so very popular. It's very male. There aren't many female characters, and that's an interesting fact in itself. So I'm going to begin the discussion by asking a few questions, then maybe we'll answer the questions. So first of all, Julius, where are the heroes? And where are the heroes in the Catholic Christian understanding of the word? In other words, where are the virtuous characters? Where are the saints or the saints in the making? And then for that matter, where are the other sort of heroes, the classical heroes, those noble souls who suffer the consequences of their tragic flaws? Where are they? Where are the Machiavels? Shakespeare's plays often have villains who are very Machiavellian. Where are the women? What does the play say about politics and politicians? What does it say about the people, the public, the mob? What does it say about the art of rhetoric? What is the play's moral perspective? All right, so I'm going to go through all of those questions. But before we do that, I want to talk about some of the historical context of the play. It dates from 1599. And what's very significant is that it's a play that was written and first performed at around the time of what became known as the Bishop's Ban. And this was the effort by the Archbishop of Canterbury, John Whitgift, and the Bishop of London, Richard Bancroft, to come together basically to succeed in getting the government to ban the publication or production, in other words, publication either through printing or through performance of any more history plays. English history plays, so plays based upon the history of England. And basically, the reason for this was mostly because of William Shakespeare. His own history plays were extremely controversial. So his plays, Henry the Fourth, Part One and Part Two, and then the comedy which arose from that, The Merry Wives of Windsor. In that, amongst other things, Shakespeare lampooned one of the founders of the proto, one of the leaders of the proto-Protestant sect, the Lollards, who were sort of Protestants 100 years or so before Luther came up with the idea. And one of the leaders was someone called Sir John Oldcastle. And when Shakespeare introduces us to Sir John Falstaff, he's referred to as the old lad of the castle, Sir John, the old lad of the castle. An unmistakable reference to Sir John Oldcastle. And the Puritans, especially, but Protestants generally, were outraged at the way that Shakespeare had turned this hero of theirs, who was lauded as a martyr in John Fox's Book of Martyrs, as a lecherous, immoral buffoon, very witty but absolutely objectionable as a character, and ridiculed in all three plays, and especially in the comedy The Merry Wives of Windsor. So that would be one reason. Also, Shakespeare's Richard II, the plot line was seen as something which could be seen to be applicable to Elizabethan England and might stir up people against the Tudor regime. And indeed, a couple of years after Julius Caesar was written, there was the Essex Rebellion. And on the eve of that rebellion, the leaders of that rebellion actually paid a theatre company in London to perform Richard II in the hope that it would indeed stir up the people to rise against tyranny. It failed, as did the rebellion. But you see here how Shakespeare's history plays were, Shakespeare's English history plays were seen as being dynamite, politically explosive. So the bishop's ban, which made it now illegal to actually publish new plays about English history. So how, what does Shakespeare do about this? Well, he turns to Rome, and so he starts producing plays about Roman history, which are not, which outside the terms of the bishop's ban, and hence Julius Caesar. Okay, so let's now go through those questions then by way of answering. Where are the heroes in a Christian sense, the virtuous characters, the saints in the making? They are absent almost entirely. The smattering of characters that we might see as being virtuous, we don't actually see enough of them to know whether how virtuous they are. So really, there are no heroes. I'm reminded, actually, showing my generation of a punk song. Strange juxtaposition, we're talking about Shakespeare. A punk song from the 1970s by the Stranglers, called No More Heroes, No More Heroes Anymore. Well, that might apply to this particular play. And as regards to classic heroes, noble characters who have tragic flaws, we could perhaps see that Julius Caesar might qualify for that, although, quite frankly, Shakespeare's depiction of him doesn't show him to be particularly noble. And the other two main protagonists, Cassius and Brutus, Cassius, Brutus, and Mark Antony, none of them really show enough nobility to have a flaw, which we would see a noble flaw that makes their fall tragic. At least that's my judgment. Shakespeare is very ambivalent about the way about the character of all of those four protagonists. Where are the Machiavels? Again, well, we do have perhaps in Cassius, someone who could be seen as a Machiavellian villain, but he's a rather pathetic Machiavel when compared to the really nasty, demonic Machiavels that we see in other Shakespeare plays, such as Iago in Othello, or Richard III, or Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, Edmund, Regan, Goneril from King Lear. Cassius, by comparison, is a rather tame and anemic Machiavel, but nonetheless, he is a Machiavellian. And where are the women? This is the question I think strikes me most. is that there's an absence of women in the play almost entirely, and yet the two women that we do see, Portia and Calpurnia, play a very important role, understated perhaps, but very, very important. I'm not going to say more about that now, because I'm going to conclude with the conclusion I wrote to the Ignatius Critical Edition of the play, which I edited and wrote the introduction to. So I'm going to read the concluding couple of paragraphs by way of concluding this podcast, and you'll see what I think about the role of the women when we get there. What does it say about politics and politicians? In some ways, this might be the most applicable to our own times, because obviously there's a lot of anger in the late 1500s, the end of the 16th century, with the tyranny in England, people being executed for their religious faith, etc., plays being banned at the whim of the government, the rise of the Puritans who hate theatre and music and liturgy. So all of this is going on. But what Shakespeare seems to be saying, and it's really prophetic of the gunpowder plot, which was only 6 years in the future, that politicians should not be trusted, regardless of which side they're on, regardless of which philosophy they claim to follow, that politics is untrustworthy and politicians are untrustworthy, and we should not be looking for the answer to the deepest issues facing humanity from politicians. What does it say about the people? And again, this is somewhat skeptical. Don't trust the people seems to be what the play says, because the people are very fickle. They support one side and then they support another. The use of rhetoric seems to be able to sway them from one extreme to the other, from being wanting to canonize, so to speak, lionize and crown as kings, one person then being swayed by the use of rhetoric to actually demonize that person and seek to kill them. So the people are not to be trusted either, certainly not the mob. We actually see in the play how an innocent poet is presumably lynched or killed just by being in the presence of the mob, and they decide on a whim to turn on him. Whether Shakespeare is alluding to himself as the poet is maybe a good question, but perhaps also a moot point. So that brings us to the next question. What does it say about the art of rhetoric? Well, it basically says that it's an art, yes, but like all art, it can be used or abused depending upon the person using it. So the gift of eloquence and of reason that are encapsulated in the art of rhetoric must be subject to moral verity and virtue, and that if it isn't, it becomes a destructive tool in the hands of evil people. And what is the moral perspective? Well, again, I think basically, and I've got to sum it up in the conclusion now, perhaps that's the best thing to do. But the moral perspective is, of course, profoundly Christian, as always. It really shows how human ambition, egocentrism, is destructive of the common good and of people. So that being said, I am now going to read the last, the conclusion to my introduction by way of concluding this podcast on Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. As with all literature, the play should be read through the eyes of the author as far as this is possible, which in Shakespeare's case means reading it through the eyes of an Orthodox Christian living in Elizabethan England. When we read the play through these eyes, which are so much more lucid than our own, or those of today's hopelessly wayward critics, we see the same profound morality emerging that we see in his other works. On the most obvious level, Shakespeare is echoing the words of Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet. He is calling down a plague on all their houses, in the sense that he is pouring scorn on Caesar's vanity, on Antony's bloodthirsty opportunism, on Cassius's ambition, on Brutus's brutal idealism. Yet, unlike Mercutio, he is not cursing from the perspective of a worldly cynic, but from that of a believing Christian at a time when believing Christians were being tortured and put to death by the vanity of monarchs, by bloodthirsty opportunists, by political ambition, and by brutal idealism. There is, however, a deeper level of meaning that is all too often overlooked completely. It is the sound of silence within the play, the scream in a vacuum, the unheard and unheeded voice of the virtuous. It is the voice of Calpurnia, which, if heeded, would have saved Caesar's life. It is the voice of Portia, which, if heeded, might have urged Brutus to think twice about his involvement with the conspirators. So there's the role of women, that the fact that they weren't listened to was the catalyst for the tragedy. So the feminine voice there is being as powerful silence in this that should have been heeded. It is the voice of the soothsayer and of the augurers. It is the voice of Artemidorus, a teacher of rhetoric, whose note to Caesar is devoid of all rhetorical devices and directed a point of bluntness. Caesar, beware of Brutus, take heed of Cassius, come not near Casca, have an eye to Cinna, trust not Trebonius, mark well Metellus Cimba, Decius Brutus loves thee not, thou hast wronged Caius Ligarius. There is but one mind in all these men, and it is bent against Caesar. If thou beest not immortal, look about you. Security gives way to conspiracy. The mighty gods defend thee. These are the words of Artemidorus, devoid of rhetorical flourish. Again, Shakespeare is probably telling us here that the plain truth should be spoken plainly. And then finally, this note is not read, the voice is not heard, and the consequences are fatal. All that was missing in the play is the one thing necessary, the still, small voice of calm that the proud refuse to hear. Well, thanks so much for joining me in this week's Home is Where the Heart Is podcast, Nina Sanctum. Please do join me next time, and until next time, goodbye and God bless.